that a British man is being held hostage in Syria by men, British men, it appears, who say that they will kill him. Realistically, what can you do to help him?
Well, it's an absolutely tragic and difficult situation, and the first thing is that everyone's thoughts and prayers should be with this man's family and with him in his difficult situation. What I have done as Prime Minister, whenever any British citizen is taken hostage anywhere in the world, is personally supervise the process of getting the whole of government together, the intelligence agencies, armed forces, Metropolitan Police, others, and ask the questions about what can we do to help them, to potentially bring them home, to make sure their families are getting the help that they need. I don't obviously want to comment in detail on this particular case for understandable reasons, but we do everything we can in every circumstance and always ask what more can be done.
Well, when you look at this circumstance, realistically, one wonders what you can do that will make a difference to him.
Well, that's true. I mean, of course, and it's been reported, and it's true that there was an attempt at a hostage rescue some weeks ago, which sadly wasn't successful. But I do think it is right, and I know people ask the question, that we shouldn't pay ransoms to terrorists in these circumstances, and Britain doesn't. And at the G8 a year or so ago, I got other world leaders to sign up to this policy and say they wouldn't do the same thing. And I know that is difficult for the families concerned on some occasions. But I'm absolutely convinced from all I've seen that when these ransoms have been paid, and tragically they have been paid in some cases, that money goes directly into kidnapping more people,
sure,
into getting arms and weapons and plotting terrorist outrages, including here in the UK.
But we are told that there are, in these situations, attempts made to open communications. Is there any point when you consider who's holding this person?
Well, I don't want to go into the details of how we manage these events for reasons people would understand. But obviously there's a world of difference between a communication and paying some ransom.
Yes, but communication suggests some form of negotiation.
Sarah, I'm not going to get into that.
Okay. You will know that it's one thing we hear, it's very visible because it's online, the videos of beheadings and the threats. There is a larger command structure behind these people that we see, and there are increasing number of calls for Britain to join America in airstrikes on ISIS. Is that something that you now think Britain should be doing?
Well, I don't rule anything out, and I think we should judge all these things in terms of our own national interest, what will help to keep us safe here at home. I absolutely think that so-called Islamic State is a direct threat to the United Kingdom. We've already seen ISIL-inspired plots in Europe, including the one where someone walked into the Jewish Museum in Brussels and killed entirely innocent people. So there's no doubt we face a threat from this organisation. We need to take every action we can domestically and then work with partners to put a fatal squeeze on this organisation. But it must start with helping those on the ground who are fighting this organisation, and that is why we're helping to supply the Kurds. Only last night, a British Hercules plane landed in Erbil to provide vital body armour for those forces. The most important thing we need is a government in Baghdad that represents all of the Iraqi people. We must make sure that the help we give is in concert with those on the ground rather than ignoring that they're there or going over their heads.
Your former defence spokesman, Liam Fox, says that basically we should be joining the Americans in airstrikes because it does help those on the ground. You damage supply lines with military power, you destroy bases, whether that's in Iraq or in Syria.
Well, these are all things that should be considered, and we've supported the American airstrikes up to now, which have been helping to make sure that the
Kurds... But are you actively considering sending British planes out to join those airstrikes?
We're not ruling anything out. I think we shouldn't underplay what Britain has done already. Our Tornado planes and Rivet Joint planes have been flying over this area to help gather information. We're working with the Americans in what they've done. We provided vital aid and humanitarian supplies. We're helping to resupply the Kurds. I've said this morning that we're looking at directly supplying arms to the Kurds and indeed helping to train some of their battalions alongside others like the Germans so we make sure they can defend the minorities that they've been doing and defend their people.
And
what we need to make sure, that there is no simple, straightforward military-led answer to this. It needs to be an entirely joined-up strategy, working with the regional partners, working with those on the ground, use what I would call a tough, long-term, intelligent approach, rather than thinking there's some simple single intervention that would make the difference.
And does that approach also mean having some sort of arrangement with President Assad in Syria, so that whatever you ultimately, the ultimate plan is with him, that you are allowed the freedom to strike ISIS in Syria?
Well, my view is that President Assad is part of the problem rather than part of the solution. If you ask yourself how come Islamic State has managed to establish itself so quickly, part of the answer is Assad's brutality in Syria gave credence to this group, while the other opposition groups, more democratic and pluralistic, didn't perhaps get the support they needed. Meanwhile, in Iraq, because there was an Iraqi government that was standing up for the Shia but not for the Sunnis and the Kurds, that again left a space for this poisonous organization to fill. So I don't see President Assad as part of the solution. He's part of the problem. What's needed both in Iraq and Syria.
You've got a difficulty is because there is effectively no longer a border between Iraq and Syria in the way that this is operating. So if you are going to deal with ISIS, if the West is going to deal with ISIS, they have to treat them, not least, this is a comment made by the American General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You can't beat them unless you tackle the problem in Syria. And in Syria, you've got an air force that can react to you.
Well, so I think the point of view I would take is that you've got to have a long-term view about what you think the right long-term answer is. And it's the same in Iraq as it is in Syria, which is a democratic, pluralistic government that can look after all of the people in the country and not brutalize a section of them. And I think that sometimes in the past, just saying my enemy's enemy is my friend has led us into all sorts of moral quagmires and difficulties.
But you've got practical hurdles then, practical hurdles to overcome to try to get to the point that you're talking about. And at the moment, you've got this ISIS, which many people would suggest is a greater threat to the whole region and to us than Assad is.
Now, if you're saying there are complicated choices and a difficult path to navigate, I absolutely agree. What I'm saying is that, you know, you've got to understand that Assad has been part of the creation of Islamic State rather than being part of its answer.
Indeed, but don't we find ourselves in a strange situation where if Iraq asks for airstrikes, they become legal? If Assad asks for airstrikes, then they become legal in Syria. And if he doesn't, it is illegal.
Well, I think if you want to talk the pure legalities, I don't think it's that complicated, because obviously the Iraqi government is a legitimate government. We believe it's about to come more legitimate with a new prime minister with the backing of all of his country, whereas President Assad has committed war crimes on his own people and therefore is illegitimate. So I think if you want to get into the legalities,
so it's that's interesting. It's not the
legality.
Okay, it's not the legality that's stopping any military action here. You feel, given the way people are behaving in the region, there would be moral and legal justification for doing something, for acting.
Obviously, we would never do anything unless there was moral and legal justification for doing something. That needs to be
said. That's what I'm wondering. Does it exist now?
But I think there's something else as well as moral and legal justification, which is that I think in the past sometimes people have seen Western intervention as something that goes right over the heads of the local people fighting these horrors and over the heads of the regional powers and neighbours. And I think what needs to be done here is to start from the proposition, what more can we do to help those, the Kurds and the Iraqis, who are fighting this battle on the ground? How do we work with the regional players and other countries to make sure that our strategy is fully joined up from everything we do domestically to keep us safe and in Iraq and in Syria to squeeze this problem at its source?
Except you have a problem that you'll be very aware of, is that people, there's almost a clamour for some form of leadership. And all we've heard, not least from President Obama, is we don't have a strategy. I mean, you're talking about strategy and people are grappling with, where's the clarity? What are we going to do?
Well, I don't accept that. I think if you look at what President Obama, Britain and others have done over recent weeks, you know, we have helped, you know, tens of thousands of people in Syria, helped to save the Yazidi people, helped to lift the siege in Amali, helped to provide aid for people who need it, building refugee camps so that people have shelter, supplied arms and support to the Kurds to protect
and the
minorities.
Sunnis? The Sunnis who are being terrorized by ISIS?
Well, they are the ones. I mean, that is why the need for a proper Iraqi government is so central for this, because if you ask yourself the question, who is truly responsible for running Iraq and squeezing this extremist organization out of existence, of course it should be a legitimate government in Baghdad, of course backed by others. But it is one of the crying needs in this situation is for that government to be formed.
Okay, well, when you look at who's responsible for this, in large part, it's British fighters who are out there. Now, you've come up with some proposals. But they, you'll know from all sides, not least from the independent reviewer of legislation, David Anderson, making the point that there are such legal difficulties and practical difficulties with what has been proposed. They're virtually unworkable.
No, I don't agree with that for one moment. I mean, look, I think everyone agrees with the basic point here, is the first thing you should do is to gather evidence, prosecute, convict and imprison extremists. And, of course, we made good progress with that. Syria-related arrests are up fivefold over the year, and there will be more arrests, I'm sure, and more work done. But we have to recognise, and all governments of all colours have recognised this, when you're fighting this Islamist extremist threat, you need more weapons than just the standard criminal law. That is why we have the Terrorism Prevention and Investigative Measures, the so-called TPIMS, so you can put people under proper control when they threaten your country. That is why we've already passed laws to strip people of their citizenship if they go and fight in Syria, if they're dual nationals or naturalised Britons. That is why we confiscate people's passports.
But the reality of taking passports off British people, depriving them of statehood, it's just not a runner, is it?
Well, no, we do that today. I mean, let's be clear. So we have the power now. If you're a dual national and you want to return to Britain, we can strip away your British citizenship. If you're a naturalised Briton who's been given permission to be a citizen, we can strip away that citizenship. If you're a foreign national who's lived in Britain for many years, we can forbid you from re-entering the country. The question I'm asking is, what can we do with the British-born, British passport holder that goes to fight? Of course, the first thing is try and prosecute and convict. The second thing is, can you put in place a terrorism prevention measure so this person is properly observed and prevented from doing harm? But I believe there should be an option in the locker to prevent that person coming back to Britain, and that is something that we're actively looking at. Where David Anderson has been very helpful as the independent reviewer is that he's suggested some improvements to the TPIMS, to the measures which we're going to put in place to strengthen them. But I would reassure listeners that, you know, we are not looking at some overhaul, some massive package of new measures. We've got a very tough set of measures in Britain, but as I've identified, there are one or two gaps in the armoury that need to be filled. I've set out how we're going to fill them, but this is not a knee-jerk reaction. This is not some mega package of measures. That's not needed. We have amazing police and intelligence and security services who work round the clock to keep us safe, and I listen very carefully to them about what they need. They're not asking for an overhaul. They're asking for some targeted measures, and that's what they're getting.
But do you ever wonder why we need this in the first place? Why it is that Britain has such a problem with people wanting to go and fight in this way? Why we have what sounds like a British man masked threatening to kill another British man?
I ask that question all the time, and I'm very clear about what the nature of the problem is. There is a poisonous narrative of Islamist extremism, an extreme worldview that has grown up, not just in Britain, but in other parts of the world. It is not the religion of Islam, which is a decent and good religion observed by billions of people around the globe. It is a perversion, and it needs to be confronted and defeated in all its forms. The reason we have a crisis with Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is not purely because of the instability of those countries. This Islamist extremist threat pops up everywhere in the world where there's a broken state or a conflict. That's why you see it in Somalia, in Mali, in parts of Nigeria. You saw it in Afghanistan, and now, tragically, you see it writ so large in Iraq and Syria. The core problem is this extremist, poisonous, medievalist worldview that it is right to torture, behead, terrorize, not just Christians and other religions, but actually your fellow Muslims as well.
Let's turn to another problem, one much closer to home. Well, a potential problem, which is the vote, the referendum in Scotland. And we've seen the polls close markedly in recent days with the suggestion that actually, despite all the predictions for months, it could be that in a matter of weeks, Scotland votes to leave the United Kingdom. Now, I wonder what you think has gone wrong with the No campaign, with the Better Together campaign. Do you think it's perhaps been too complacent, perhaps too negative? It's not saying what we, you know, what the rest of the UK loves about Scotland. It's saying how they'd be worse off.
I don't think it's been negative or complacent. I think the No campaign is working very hard to make an important set of arguments. Certainly my role in the campaign has been to make a wholly positive case, very much saying to people in Scotland, look, it is your choice, but be in no doubt, the rest of the United Kingdom, England, Wales, Northern Ireland, we want you to stay. And my argument throughout, and I believe a very large part of the No campaign's argument, is not saying, look, Scotland can't be independent. Of course, it could be independent, but we'd all be better off by staying together. And that
it's still ahead, though. I wonder how much heart. Do you feel like putting more heart into it and saying, sort of, Scotland, we love you, stay with us?
I've absolutely said that in terms, and will say so again on my next campaign visit. And I think the arguments of the heart, that, you know, you can be a proud Scot, but also a proud Brit. In fact, I would argue you can be far prouder of your Scottishness, your Scottish identity, your belief in Scottish history and traditions, and still believe, far prouder of that than your Britishness, but still believe that you can succeed in a United Kingdom. It's not true that the only patriotic option is to vote yes. You can be a proud patriotic Scot, but believe in this family of nations that we have the United Kingdom.
So if you are Prime Minister, if Scotland votes to go independent, and therefore you are in charge when you're overseeing the demise of the United Kingdom as it has been for 300 years, will you see that as a resignation matter, that actually you should say, I failed to keep this country together, I resign?
I think it's very important to say no to that emphatically for this reason, that what's at stake here is not this Prime Minister or that Prime Minister or this party leader or that party leader. What is at stake is the future of Scotland. It is for the Scottish people to decide, do you want to separate yourself from the United Kingdom or do you want to stay in the United Kingdom?
Sure, and I'm talking about after the vote. Really, I'm saying, you know, you'll end up being Prime Minister of the rest of the United Kingdom, who may feel a little bit hard done by.
No, but I think it's very important for people in Scotland to realise the consequence of their vote is purely and simply about Scotland and its place in the United Kingdom. We shouldn't try and tie up into this vote the future of Alex Salmond,
so,
or the future of me,
now,
or anybody else.
I ask
else.
You after the vote.
Well, Sarah, I'll come on your programme whenever you like. You can always ask me whatever you like. I'm giving you a very clear answer. In this case, this is about the future of Scotland. It's a desperately important question. I care passionately about it. As I said, it would break my heart if Scotland were to leave the United Kingdom. But I absolutely believe it's right to give people in Scotland the choice. You have to remember the circumstances in which this all came about, which is that Scotland voted for a Scottish National Party majority government whose policy was to hold a referendum. Now, if the British government, led by me, had said, you're not having a referendum, we don't care, that would have been a disastrous approach and would have only made Scottish independence more likely. Instead, what we've done is make sure there is a fair, decisive and legal referendum. But I dearly hope the Scottish people will vote to stay in our family of nations.
David Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now, at coming up to 8:30...